Good morning and welcome back to the Strategic Investment Conference. I'm Ed D'Agostino, and I've got a very busy day in store for you. We're going to hear from David Rubenstein, Barry Habib, Katie Stockton, Jared Dillian, Barry Ritholtz, Sam Rhines, David Brokaas, and more. It's going to be a full day. Let's get right into it. In 2016, our next guest published a book titled 2017, War with Russia, an urgent warning from senior military command. And while the book was technically fiction, it was a stern warning about the very real risks posed by Vladimir Putin's actions and his desire to expand Russia's borders. The book's author is none other than the former Deputy Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, the UK's Sir General Richard Sheriff. During his 40 years of active duty, the general served stints in the Gulf War, Kosovo, and Iraq. He'll be speaking with our friend Jacob Shapiro, director of geopolitical analysis at investment advisory firm Cognitive Investments. Gentlemen, thank you and welcome to the Strategic Investment Conference.
Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Ed, and it's an honor to be with you, Sir Richard. We have 50 minutes, and it's going to be a challenge for me to keep us on that. I'd like to divide our conversation into really two halves. I thought we would start just talking about the conflict itself and then zooming out and talking about some of the global implications. And I really wanted to start with what is a deceptively simple question. Can you just update the audience on what is sort of the latest in terms of the conflict and the war right now on the ground from your perspective, from a military perspective?
I think what we're seeing now, firstly, it's a pleasure to be with you all, ladies and gentlemen. In terms of where we're at the moment, well, clearly Russia has not succeeded in its aims. Russia had intended quite clearly to conquer Ukraine with a shock and awe campaign, multiple advances on multiple axes from east, south, and north, but they failed. They failed for three reasons. One is the Ukrainians have fought back with extraordinary courage, tenacity, ingenuity, and guile, and inflicted quite a defeat on them, particularly in the battle for Kiev. Secondly, Putin underestimated the capability of his own armed forces, and the Russian army and air force have proved to be lamentably poor at the science and art of war. They failed to their command and control, failure to understand combined arms operations, failure of logistics, and the morale of the soldiers has been appalling. The third area has been the response of the West and the huge support provided by America, by other NATO allies, by other NATO partners. I think of Australia and other countries who have flooded in weapons and capability to support the Ukrainians. We might come back to that later. Where we're at the moment is that the Russians have launched their much vaunted Battle of the Donbass, attacking on a 300-kilometer frontage to really close down the Ukrainian force army in the provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk. It is not going according to plan. However, what we're seeing is steady growing attrition with the aim of ultimately defeating the Ukrainian armed forces in the Donbass. But I don't think they're getting it, that they're not having it their own way. Command and control, question marks. There we have General Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, the chief of, think of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. That's the equivalent figure, post he occupies. Allegedly wounded while visiting a forward headquarters in which over 20 other senior officers were killed. So they're not getting it their own way. The West has responded as well with the continued supply of weaponry and ammunition. And the Ukrainians continue to fight. And the messages that I'm getting from Ukrainian contacts is that if they get the weapons, the Ukrainians are quite convinced that they will defeat the Russians. And that is a noble aim to have. I think the most likely outcome is probably that the Russians will continue this terrible war of attrition, the destruction of Ukrainian cities, and I'm afraid that the unspeakable things and atrocities they've been doing to civilians as well. But the Ukrainians will hold them, and we're likely to see a slowdown into a almost a sort of 1915 to 1918 on the Western Front trench line, which will not be a frozen conflict. It will be very much a hot conflict, and it is likely to continue for some time. So that's a quick starter by way of a thought from where we are, Jacob.
Yeah, there's good news in there, but also a lot of bad news when we start talking about trench warfare as sort of a comparison. I wanted to ask, has the performance of the Russian military, or I should say the lack of performance from the Russian military, surprised you? Is it what you were expecting? And do you think that their military has already reached a point where, you know, they continue in Donbass, but that they can't continue with offensive operations? Or do you lend some credence to these reports circulating that Putin is talking about a mass mobilization maybe by May 9th, and Russia trying to recommit forces and reinforce away from its original objective and maybe being able to push further within its own limited objective? How do you rate the capacity of the Russian military here going forward?
I think, firstly, I completely overestimated the capability of the Russians. I thought they would be much, much better at this, even in Soviet days. The Soviet army understood the integration of artillery, air power with land maneuver, as also combined arms battles, but the whole issue of infantry and armor supporting each other. So I completely underestimated that. And I don't know what they've been doing while they were camped, while that huge buildup took place on the borders of Ukraine. I think they were camping rather than training. I think what we see is an army that is fundamentally rotten to the core, a failure of leadership, a failure of morale, corruption, criminality, and all translated into the most appalling brutality and contempt for human lives. Will they learn from it? I think it's pretty unlikely. I think by all accounts, the Russians have taken really significant casualties. Over a quarter of the force that launched the invasion has effectively been rendered combat ineffective by many creditable observers of the scene. And you don't turn that round quickly. I mean, I think if I'd been General Sverdikov, the newly appointed Russian joint commander, after the failure of the Battle of Kiev, I would have taken the army, done a complete reset, looked in detail at command and control, looked at where things went wrong, worked through a series of training exercises to get it right, reinforced, tested, and ensure the logistics were in place, and put in place measures to improve morale. They didn't do that. They launched into the second battle of the Donbass very quickly, probably because Putin is looking for a victory to be able to declare for his parade on the 9th of May. How he comes back from this, and I do think talk of a general mobilization is entirely credible. And I think that we could easily see a declaration of war against NATO on the 9th of May. We already hear men like Lavrov, and Putin has already declared it, that this is a war against NATO de facto. And of course, if he does declare this to be a war against NATO, then he can order general mobilization, which means drawing on greater supplies of manpower in order to boost the forces. But even then, it's going to take time. You can't just bring in overall conscription and expect to turn recruits into soldiers in quick time, and also to mobilize reserves. So my sense would be that if there's mobilization next week, we're not going to see the Russians generate that sort of combat power, significant additional combat power, much before the end of the summer. But I may be wrong. They may rush it.
Yeah, I want to put a pin in that what you said about the Declaration of War to NATO, and we'll come right back to that in a second. But before we leave the specific topic, just one more thing. I mean, as somebody who has led soldiers yourself and been a general and been in the field, is there a silver lining to take in this, that the morale of the Russian army is so bad? Is that an indication that maybe Russia is not on board with whatever is coming out of the Putin regime and could indicate some weakness there? Or am I grasping for hope where there is none, and this is really just, you know, a military that is not well led, but we shouldn't take anything from that lack of morale into maybe Russia opposes what the Putin regime is doing?
I think I completely understand that thinking, Jacob, but I my sense would be that, and firstly, of course, the Russian army reflects Russian society, like every army reflects a society from which its soldiers, its officers are drawn. It's an army that is corrupt. It's a corrupt kleptocracy, which reflects Russia. My sense with Russian society as a whole, though, is because Putin has controlled the levers of information in the way he has and for the length of time he has, that in many ways, Russian civil society it has been destroyed in the sense of any possible opposition, any sort of free media, and that poisonous propaganda that is being put out about denazification of Ukraine, elimination of Ukraine as a state, is very much the popular view. Yes, there are brave voices who may speak out, but generally speaking, I think we're getting the message that this is so deeply entrenched in society that it's very difficult to turn that round. But coming back to your point about morale, I mean, the silver lining here for us who are looking to see the defeat of Russia is that, as Napoleon said, the moral is to the physical as 3 is to 1. You don't turn around rotten morale overnight. You have to have soldiers who feel valued, who feel they're looked after, who feel inspired, who are prepared to put their lives on the line for a greater cause. And we're not seeing that with the Russian army. So I think that that rot that is in the Russian army will continue to spread like a cancer and will ultimately undermine them. But I don't think we should jump to too many conclusions about the rest of Russian society suddenly gradually turning round and taking becoming too strong in opposition. Having said that, if the casualty levels that we've seen thus far, and by all accounts the Russians are continuing to take really heavy casualties in the Battle of the Donbass, that message is going to get through eventually, but it'll take a long time.
If we can take the flip side of that question almost and go back to what you were saying about potentially a Russian declaration of war on NATO, I mean, a shiver went down my spine when you said that. And I wonder, what is NATO's response to that? What is the morale, do you think, of NATO to oppose that? Yes, there has been support in terms of weaponry to Ukraine. Yes, there have been sanctions, and the Europeans seem to be talking about oil. Maybe they'll eventually get to natural gas. But none of these things seem to have deterred Russia. And if Russia is going to go to the extent of a declaration of war on NATO, I mean, NATO has basically tried to stay out of the direct fray. What happens from NATO's perspective if Moscow goes that route?
Well, this is a strategic shift if Putin goes as far as declaring war on NATO. But as I said, he feels he's at war with NATO already and has said as much. The message from NATO is that NATO stays calm, stays united. But NATO also needs to undergo a complete mindset change, and we've not yet seen that in NATO. Yes, there has been some reinforcement of NATO's eastern flank, and yes, we've seen the serious ramping up of weaponry and heavy weaponry, artillery, tanks, anti-aircraft systems into Ukraine, into support the Ukraine armed forces, and potentially aircraft as well. But the mindset change in NATO, and this I think is fundamental, and it should have been, so it is absolutely, it should have been going, in my view, step by step with the ramping up of support, is that NATO, all 30 member states of NATO, need to be ready for war with Russia, need to be ready for the worst case. That doesn't mean to say we're going to go to war with Russia, but the way to ensure that we don't end up in a knife fight with Russia is to prepare ourselves for the worst case, build up our deterrent capability in Eastern Europe to make it absolutely clear that if Putin steps across that key red line, which is an attack on any NATO country, NATO is ready to mallet him harder than he thought he could ever be malleted. And I we're not there yet, because that means it means a ramp up of defense spending. Forget the 2% of GDP on defense. It means probably 4 or 5% of GDP on defense. It means effectively a remilitarization of our societies in a way which we have not seen since the Cold War. It means rearmament. It means building up the size of our armed forces. And it means not being prepared to settle down for a long Cold War, because the challenge we face is to ensure that that hot war in Ukraine does not become a hot war across the NATO, the rest of NATO. And as I say, I've yet to hear any NATO political leader say that. The British Foreign Secretary last week gave a very clear speech in which she laid out a clear strategic objective. She made some very powerful messages about 2% of GDP on defense being the floor and not the ceiling. But there's got to be, in anything, like in any strategy, it's about integrating the ways and the means, the actions and the resources in pursuit of the ends or the desired end state. And that requires, so the devil is in the detail, and we need to see NATO leaders now put their money where their mouths are.
Yeah, I agree with you that we have not seen that sort of attitude shift in NATO. But one thing we have seen is that both Finland and Sweden have fairly quickly decided that they want to join NATO as well. And those are significant militaries with significant exposure to Russia in general. Do you think, and Putin has been very scared about this, and the Russian foreign ministry has been warning about all the threats that they're going to carry out if Finland and Sweden join. Does Sweden and Finland joining NATO, is that the sort of thing that is good? Do you see other countries that could join NATO that could help increase that deterrence? How do you assess Finland and Sweden joining and how that affects this conflict overall?
That is really good news for NATO. It's good news for every single country in NATO. Finland and Sweden will cement the security in the Baltic. And as you say, they have really capable militaries. And of course, we will see an awful lot of Russian bluster. The bottom line with Russia, the bottom line with Putin particularly, is that he is terrified of NATO, which is why it's what drives him in so many of his motives. He sees NATO as an alliance that directly threatens Russia. Of course, it doesn't. We want to live in peace with Russia. Russia is a great nation, and we should be living at peace with Russia. And I'm sure come the day when Putin or his Putin-esque successors have moved on, we might one day, God grant us, God willing, find ourselves in a state of being able to live with Russia peacefully. So we'll see a lot of pushback from Russia. But the alliance has got to stay strong, and I'm sure it will stay strong. And I'm sure that there will be senior NATO people as we speak in Brussels working out a fast track signing up of Finland and Sweden, should the Finns and the Swedes give a green light to NATO membership, as I very much hope they will do, so that the alliance is able to, as pretty near instantly, provide that assurance of collective defense, Article 5, and sort out the detail later.
You already spoke about a red line for NATO, which would be an attack on a NATO state. I shudder to ask this question because I'm afraid of your answer. But one of the things that I feel like observers have been worried about since the beginning is Russia using chemical weapons in Ukraine, or even, God forbid, Russia using a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine. Do you take those reports with any credence? Do you think that that is possible? And would that constitute some kind of red line for NATO? Or is it really NATO is its black and white? As long as there is not an attack on a NATO state, anything that happens in Ukraine will be contained sort of at the level of Ukraine and not beyond that.
I think we should absolutely take seriously any suggestion that Russia might use chemical weapons or nuclear weapons in Ukraine. However, I think I'll stick my neck out and say at the moment, I think it's unlikely. And why would he want to, in a sense? Because chemical weapons can be pretty self-defeating. As soon as you let chemical weapons out, you know, you're subject to the vagaries of wind and weather, and you could find that stuff blowing back on your own people and into Russia as well, as with potentially radioactive fallout. The same could happen. And why bother? I mean, why do you need to go down that way? Look at what he's done to Mariupol with conventional weapons. Look at what he's done to other Ukrainian cities with conventional weapons. As far as the red line is concerned, would that constitute a red line for NATO if it's an attack in Ukraine? Well, what he's done to Mariupol, that total destruction of a city, has not been a red line for NATO to get involved. So I think NATO will hold very firmly to the red line that says it's an attack on NATO that will provoke NATO involvement, and avoid getting drawn in, requiring to any activity in Ukraine which constitutes an act of war. However, what really worries me is not a conventional attack on NATO, because I don't think Putin's ever going to be able to do that with the state of his armed forces at the moment, and because of the extent to which he is completely fixed in military terms in Ukraine. What does worry me is a missile attack on for example, an air base in a NATO country where weaponry and support and ammunition is coming in before being shipped into Ukraine. He's already the reports of missile attacks on Lviv this morning, targeting the Ukrainian rail network and supply lines. It wouldn't be too much of a stretch of imagination to see that happening into NATO territory. But Putin will know and needs to know that NATO will respond ruthlessly and with total power to destroy the missile batteries from whence any missile attacks are launched, if he does attack a NATO country. Which comes back to the point of being strong.
Yeah. Do you have any information about Putin's own mental state or even his health? There have been reports since the beginning of this conflict that he's mentally unwell or physically unwell, and I am fairly dismissive of those types of reports because I feel like that's usually what happens when you don't understand a person. I think it's clear what Putin wants to do. We just don't like what he wants to do, and it makes us feel morally uncomfortable. But have you heard anything about Putin himself? One of the things that struck me when we were prepping for this call was you said there would be no settlement with Russia as long as Putin was leader. So the idea that maybe Putin is unwell again, I'm grasping for hopefulness. But I just wonder if you have any information or have heard anything about those reports.
I'm getting the same reports as you, Jacob. I was interested to see the British tabloid newspaper, The Sun, reporting that Putin is about to go under the knife for a cancer operation, and that the head of the FSB is going to stand in for him. And we've seen, most of us saw that clip on social media where Putin is conducting an interview, and for 15 minutes he's grasping the table to support himself and looks as if he's been embalmed. But I think we're all grasping at straws and at hopes. If it happens, well, so much the better in a way. Couldn't happen to a nicer man. But on the other hand, I think we have to be realistic about that and the chances of that happening. We have to accept, assume the worst, that Putin is hale, healthy, and will go on. And I stand by what I said when we were prepping the call, when I said that there will never be peace in Europe while Putin is in the Kremlin. And even if Putin leaves the Kremlin, if another hardliner takes over, that could prolong this. But on the other hand, if there is some form of power shift in the Kremlin, an internal coup driven by the security apparatus who know and can understand the catastrophic impact of this war on Russia and on the Russian military, there may be somebody who takes over who would be prepared to hold out an olive branch, but we can't assume that. Again, we just have to knuckle down for the long haul. We have to be prepared for the worst case, and we have to see NATO preparing for that worst case.
Yeah. I want to ask you one more question on sort of the immediate conflict, and then we'll zoom out for some larger consequences for investors, supply chains, and take some lessons also about resilience from your time in NATO itself. But If the audience has not read your book, I would highly recommend them to read it. And I wanted to ask, one of the major focal points of your book that was, I think, 2016, 2017 that came out, was the Baltic states, so Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. And I wanted to ask you, should they be sleeping better tonight because the Russian military has not performed well and maybe Moscow doesn't have the capability to go after them in an aggressive way? Or should it be the opposite? Should they be even more nervous because once Russia licks its wounds and gets to some kind of stabilizing point in Ukraine, that Vladimir Putin will have designs on them and on other regions in Europe?
I'm absolutely convinced, Jacob, that his long-term intent to reestablish a Russian empire, to bring Russian speakers under the banner of Mother Russia, to establish what he described as a new Yalta, as the most appropriate security settlement for Europe. In other words, Russian power over former Warsaw Pact countries in Eastern Europe, and to bring in the former Soviet republics back under the banner of Russia, has not gone away. The people of the Baltic states are resilient. They're tough. They're men and women who understand the price of freedom. They liberated themselves effectively when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they know Russia all too well. They will be wary. They will be realistic. They will be happy to see the way the Russian army has fixed itself and the way it has performed so woefully in Ukraine. But they will have no illusions that come the day, Russia will be back. And they will also be leaning even more strongly into NATO. And we, the Western European countries of NATO, together, of course, with America and Canada, need to be leaning even more strongly to support them.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that better myself. So let's zoom out a little bit here. And when we're talking more about the sort of global ramifications of the Russia-Ukraine war, I think the first question has to go to China. And that is, namely, what do you think that China has taken as a lesson from Russia's war in Ukraine? Is it that the West was more responsive and was able to act as a coherent entity more than perhaps Russia expected, and that is a deterrence for China going forward when it thinks about Taiwan? Is it the opposite? It sees that nobody actually intervened in terms of troops on the ground with Ukraine, and that means, okay, nobody's going to save Taiwan with troops. What lessons do you think in Beijing they are learning from the conflict? And if we could tack on a second part of that question, if you were advising Xi Jinping right now, what lessons would you tell him to take from the conflict versus what they are taking from the conflict?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the first thing I think China will be, the first lesson they will be taking from this conflict as they look at the West is that the West, in a sense, in the first world sense of NATO and its immediate partners such as Australia and other countries like that, is no pushover, and the West has come together remarkably strongly. And China won't like that. China won't like the impact. China will be looking, for example, at the sanctions imposed on Russia, and China would not want to go there. I think China will be looking at what Russia has done in Ukraine, and for all the talk of that bond of unbreakable friendship between Xi and Putin, and we should not underestimate that axis of autocrats, who, in a sense, will continue to depend on each other. But at the same time, I think China will want to distance itself from that invasion of Ukraine, because it breaks that fundamental principle that China is always preaching to the rest of the world about the importance of respecting sovereign nations and not interfering in the rights of sovereign nations. There's an economic point here, of course, that China has significant markets in Europe, a significant Belt and Road investment in Eastern Europe in particular. China has investments in Odessa, and they will not want to see Odessa being shelled and rocketed, and the economic activity of Odessa being disrupted as a result of this war. As far as Taiwan is concerned, I think they will look at the defense put up by the Ukrainians, a David and Goliath battle, and they will not be slow to jump to conclusions that actually Taiwan will be a serious to attack Taiwan is going to be a bigger prospect, a bigger challenge than they had probably assumed. The Taiwanese have put together, they're under no illusions. They've fought through the nature of their defense. It's not an easy country to attack. And of course, any amphibious operation is the most challenging operation of war. And it's not an easy, so that is not an easy thing for the Chinese to do, particularly as the Chinese military have not got, yes, they've had a lot of investment, but they have not got a lot of combat experience. The last time the Chinese engaged in any combat operations was against the Vietnamese in the 80s, and they came off second best. So I think if I was advising Xi, I would advise caution. I would advise him to continue the economic domination and commercial quasi-imperialism of the Belt and Road. And I tell you where I also would focus him on is the Third World. I talk about the unity of the West and the unity of NATO countries and the Western Alliance. But we should be under no illusions that those views are shared globally. Many countries in Africa will be supporting Putin because the Russians, for better or for worse, under the Soviets, were seen as after the decolonization of Africa by the imperial countries in Africa, and in the 60s, it was the Russians or the Soviets who moved in to provide support, aid, military training, etc. in the 70s and 80s in many countries. And so the Russians will be seen as the good guys, and there will be many in the Third World who think that NATO, the Americans, had this coming to them and will be fundamentally sympathetic to Putin despite the terrible things that his people, his soldiers, are doing to Ukraine. And then, of course, you've got countries like India, some really significant countries and big players who are naturally sympathetic to the Russians, who have tied themselves to Russian the Russian military, and much of their military equipment comes from Russia. They will continue to sit uneasily on the fence, but I think the West needs to be quite clear with them that if India wants to be seen as a proud democratic country that it is, it should recognize the democratic principles and the democratic rights of Ukraine as well.
You spoke about NATO needing to have a mind shift and about increasing defense spending in order to deter Russia and to prepare for a long war with Russia. I wonder if you think also that NATO is going to have to think in those terms with China and whether the world really is going to bifurcate into these two separate systems. And when you say 4 to 5% of GDP, are you talking just about Russia? Are you talking about the potential threat posed by a Russia and a China that are helping each other as they try to undermine the global order? Does NATO even have the kind of resources to take on both of those powers at the same time? Or like you said, is China not going to go all the way here with Russia? And maybe there is a way to use sanctions and China's exposure to Western markets as a way to say, hey, there's a red line here that you don't cross, China. And yes, we'll have our problems with you, but you're not the primary sort of military enemy from that perspective.
Well, NATO is a regional organization focused on defense and security in the transatlantic region. But I think that, NATO is also has many partners across the world. So NATO is in a very good position to export its brand, but I don't see NATO, in a sense, stepping up as an alliance to defend against Chinese aggression. However, what we have already seen with the AUKUS pact, is the development of alliances which can draw on NATO experience, NATO expertise, to provide deterrence in the Asia-Pacific region. So that is where I think I would be putting my money. Like-minded nations with interests in the Asia-Pacific region. I think it's unfortunate that AUKUS does not include France, for example, because France is de facto a Pacific power. And I think I would be harnessing like-minded democratic nations into treaty organizations to deter China in the Asia-Pacific region. And that's important because whatever happens in Ukraine, Xi will, I might pick that, it's a point I perhaps should have made earlier. He will be looking at this as an opportunity to continue to exert Chinese muscle, military and economic, in the Asia-Pacific region. We've already seen, for example, we're seeing in the Solomon Islands, the Chinese getting in there, which of course is a concern to the Australians. And China will use every opportunity to use the Ukraine conflict which is distracting, focusing the rest of the world, to exert more muscle in the South China Sea. And that creeping nationalism that we've already seen, the reclamation of islands and the like, I'm sure will continue. So I think the West needs to support the two principal Pacific nations of democratic nations of America and Australia in forming a strong alliance, drawing, I think, on NATO expertise and support in doing that.
Yeah. The next sort of global big picture question I wanted to ask you was, from your perspective, what do you think the Russia-Ukraine war means for global supply chains? And, you know, a lot of this audience here, a lot of executives, a lot of investors, what types of things do you think they should be looking for or should be worried about from a global perspective in terms of maybe the ramifications of this war that they haven't thought about?
I think the first thing we need to be worried about is food and famine. Ukraine provides a third of the world's grain. It is really important to a number of North African, Middle East, and indeed African countries and globally. That is going to dry up this year. There will be no harvest. And that is going to lead to food shortages. And when there's food shortages, there's instability. And when there's instability, there is governments get toppled and there is insecurity. And so I think the potential impact of that across much of North Africa, the Middle East, and indeed the rest of Africa is really significant. Remember that the Arab Spring, one of the underlying causes of the Arab Spring were food shortages, and that led to the sort of instability and the political instability that we saw as a result of that. I think we're going to see that, but in a much, much greater way. So I think that would be the first thing we would need to worry about. The so what for me is the West needs to be thinking ahead, in a sense, wargaming which countries may well be in the frame for instability, and taking active measures to provide support to governments in fragile states to shore them up and ensure that they remain as stable as they possibly can. I think more widely, supply chains are, and it's sort of on the back of the pandemic. I think the consequences of the pandemic, and of course the fact that China is now back in the grip of the pandemic as well, and they're facing real issues. So many of those supply chains will be challenged too. I think there's a real message here about resilience building. And there is, nobody can foretell the future. Nobody can see where the crisis will come. But I think it places an imperative on companies dependent on complex global supply chains to look at alternative sources of supply, perhaps closer to home, perhaps domestically, but also I mentioned the word wargaming. That is a great way of testing plans, testing strategic resilience in a safe to fail environment, where you put together an exercise with a red team who can represent your adversaries, your competitors, regulators, governments, and throw in wild cards as you go through and you test your plans. And where those plans don't shape up, you can readjust them to ensure they do, but also to ensure that your crisis management plans are really sound and really properly practiced. So I think building resilience becomes a commercial imperative. I think we saw with the pandemic that the need to shave margins, which of course is absolutely the right thing to do, to shave costs. You need to be putting part of your margins need to be invested in building resilience, and I think that's going to be an increasing importance.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because one of the questions I couldn't wait to ask you was, you know, as somebody who was a deputy commander of NATO and has led so many groups in so many ways, I actually wanted to ask you specifically, what is your definition of resilience? I think that resilience is a word that gets thrown around a lot and people don't actually sit down and actually interrogate, well, what does that mean? And then what do I actually have to do to have resilience, whether it's in my portfolio or as a military unit or in a supply chain? So I just wanted to ask you sort of directly, could you describe to us what you think resilience is and how you've thought about resilience throughout the course of your career?
Resilience to me is about being able to withstand the shocks, the unexpected shock, that event that comes out of a clear blue sky for which you hadn't thought. It's about being ready to take that, and that requires the ability to it requires strength in depth. It requires the ability to call on reserves. It's all about maintaining a reserve against the unexpected. But it's also a mindset requirement, because, and it's not impossible to do. It's not rocket science, this. It's about sitting down and thinking through the unexpected, perhaps by means of a we call it in my business a business game, and we've done it quite extensively with companies, funnily enough, not companies exposed in China, and actually currently in Ukraine too. It's all about testing in a safe to fail environment where you can think through your plans. Test your plans. It doesn't matter if you get it wrong, because in getting it wrong, you can then build an intellectual muscle memory so that when it happens for real, you're in a much better place to deal with the unexpected. And I think also it's about ensuring your plans, the plans which underpin your strategy, are flexible. It was the great General Eisenhower who said, it's not the plan that matters, it's the planning. And that's a key principle, I think. What he meant by that, I think, was that as you plan, you develop an intuitive understanding of the external factors at work and perhaps the internal factors. You could as easily call them the risks, so that when a risk materializes, you can intuitively adjust your plan to cope with what's being thrown at you. Of course, it's the Mike Tyson line of everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. It's ensuring, or Moltke, who said, no plan survives contact with the enemy. It's the same idea. I bet Mike Tyson had never heard of General von Moltke. But it's the same principle, being ready to take the hit when it comes, and having thought through. It may not reflect precisely how you've thought about it, but if you have that intellectual muscle memory, it gives you the agility to adjust when things do go wrong, as they surely will.
Yeah, that's what a great answer. And I wanted to talk about one of those major external factors, maybe as a way towards starting to wrap up here, which is that it seems to me that the biggest punch in the mouth, especially for Europeans, has to be this dependence on Russian energy, which is not the sort of thing that you can't flip a switch overnight. And in some ways, it's an example of failing to plan ahead and failing to be resilient, because these European companies are going to be so dependent on Russian natural gas. I mean, even the most ardent supporters of an embargo on Russia, it seems to be end of 2023 to where they're going to be able to get off of Russian natural gas. So from both a global perspective and also as a European and a European perspective as well, what does the Russia-Ukraine war mean from energy security? And how fast do you think that Europe can wean itself off of Russia? And how long does that actually give Russia maybe a lifeline to continue some of its aggressive operations, because it knows it can continue to sell that energy to Europe because they can't get it from anywhere else?
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. There are a number of European countries who have thrown their lot in completely with and are totally dependent on Russian gas for their energy, notably Germany and Austria. Others are not so dependent. I mean, UK is way, way down in its dependence on Russian energy, although it's still coming in. And we need to be absolutely clear that as long as European countries are buying Russian gas, European countries are funding the Russian war machine and the sort of terrible activities that we're seeing the Russians commit and the atrocities the Russians commit. So there is an absolute imperative for Russia, for Europe, to cut off its dependence on Russian oil and gas. And that will begin to have, once that happens, it will have a serious effect, no question about it, on the Russian economy. So economics, as economic warfare, is as important as the military side. But we also should recognize that if Europe cut itself off immediately, there would be massive economic shocks as well. So it's about recognizing the risks of those shocks. It's not going to happen overnight. I think we have to accept that. But we should be seeing those countries in Europe which are most dependent on Russian gas taking seriously active measures now to find alternative sources. And I know the Germans are trying to do that, but it's going to take. But they need to really redouble their efforts. I mean, smaller countries like Estonia have absolutely overnight cut themselves off from it. Sacrifices do have to be made here because it's an existential fight.
Yeah, and one of the things that you said really struck out to me, which was thinking about the developing world or the third world. I mean, one of the things that came across my desk in the last week was, you know, Italy saying that it was signing gas deals or oil exploration deals in Angola or in the Republic of Congo. So it seems like even NATO member states are going to have to think a little bit differently about energy security. And you talked about sort of, you know, spending on military to deter Russia. But I wonder if you could also talk about the importance of, you know, engaging with the rest of the world as well and making sure there are alternatives and securing those alternate sources of supply, because it seems to me that NATO is only going to be as strong as its ability to call on the resources of the rest of the world, since Russia is basically isolating itself from the continent.
And that's so right. And of course, picking up the discussion earlier about supply chain, if you're going for alternative sources of energy from Angola or for Congo. And of course, huge amounts of battery minerals come from the DRC, which is a deeply, deeply unstable country. This places a real premium on understanding risk. And it's about understanding risk comprehensively. It's about understanding the relationships between risk. It's about linking risk and strategy and embedding effective risk management in your strategy, which is something I think that companies can learn. I mean, the military can't, you know, anybody who served in the military in the two campaigns of the first decades of this century, which most of us in America and UK did in Afghanistan and Iraq, we know things did not go right. But my goodness me, there are lessons to be learned from how the military adjusted to those challenges. And those lessons are as relevant in the private sector as they are in the military, particularly in a world as unstable as the world we find ourselves in at the moment. So yes, NATO countries will have to look further afield for energy, but they will have to think very carefully about the risks. It's not impossible to do that, but they need to embed risk management and risk thinking in at the earliest stages of their planning.
Yeah. We've got just about three to four more minutes left. So I thought we would close by, when we were in the green room waiting to get on the call, I asked you, are you more pessimistic or less pessimistic about the war based on everything that's happened in the past month? Because, you know, we spoke last month and we're preparing this call. And I remember Ed and John and I all sitting with you and prepping for the call thinking, this guy's describing the end of the world. This is very scary. It's really going to shake up sort of the strategic investment conference audience. So I wanted to ask you sort of, you know, give that same answer to the audience. Are you more or less pessimistic based on where we are today? And sort of what do you think are the worst case scenarios going forward? Or is there any silver lining for the audience to take?
Well, as I said earlier, I'm going to equivocate here. And so I'm both more and less. I'm less pessimistic because when this war kicked off on the 24th of February, my real worry was that Ukraine would collapse immediately and that Putin would turn his attention to, for example, the Baltic states. And that would create, that would generate war with NATO. And we have to recognize that if we get to that stage of war with NATO, it is war between two nuclear powers. And in Putin, we have a man obsessed, a man potentially running out of time physically on the health front, a man who's anyway getting older, and a man who may well feel that he has nothing to lose by launching a nuke, which would be utter catastrophe. Because if that is the case, then the only response is another nuke. And that means we're back to the Dark Ages, frankly. I mean, it's just too grim to think about. excuse me. The silver lining is, number one, that NATO has not been involved, except in the supply of weaponry. The silver lining is the way NATO has stepped up to the mark and is now providing weapons, ammunition, and heavy weapons and ammunition. the silver lining is absolutely the courage, tenacity, and strength of the Ukrainians and their total determination to defeat Russia. Also, a similar silver lining is the incompetence of the Russians, and they're not going to put that right quickly. The Russians traditionally have always been, you know, they ultimately get it right, as we saw, go back to Barbarossa, the Nazi invasion of Russia, of Soviet Union in 1941. The Russians, the Soviets took extraordinarily massive losses, but they are resilient. They demonstrated resilience. And when push came to shove, they fought with a fanatical patriotism for the motherland. I don't think we're going to see that with Russian conscripts dragooned into fighting against their Slav brothers in Ukraine. So that remains a silver lining. But the most important silver lining, and I think my conclusion, I keep saying this, is that NATO, the way to preserve, the way to maintain, ensure that that hot war in Ukraine doesn't become a hot war in Europe, which engulfs the NATO alliance and threatens nuclear Armageddon, is for NATO to be strong. And that means that all our societies in NATO have to make sacrifices. The easy days are gone. We have to invest in military capability because peace is precious, and we need to be prepared to pay to preserve it.
Yeah, the easy days are gone. I think that's the title right there. So let me just say, Sir Richard, it's been an honor to be with you, and I hope the next time you and I get to talk, it's over happier subjects and not something like this.
Thank you very much for having me, Jacob, and great to talk.
Indeed. General Sir Richard Sheriff and Jacob Shapiro, thank you both for your insights and for this frank but important conversation. Audience, we'll be back in 10 minutes with my friend and associate, Joe Anthony. He's the CEO of Sterling Legacy Real Estate Fund, and he brings with him two very special guests who he'll introduce to you in 10 minutes. See you then.